Book of Ruth, chapter 3. Seeking a resting place or how to get a husband in an unusual way. Boaz is down in the threshing floor. Oftentimes they slept all night on the threshing floor, either to prevent robberies or just because they worked such long hours in the peak of the harvest. They worked past dark, lay down and slept, got up early in the morning and continued on. Verse 3, wash thyself therefore and anoint thee. Put thy raiment upon thee and get thee down to the floor. But make not thyself known unto the man until he shall have done eating and drinking. Now washing yourself and anointing yourself is preparation. There's a preparation that has to go into this proposal. It shall be when he lieth down, you shall mark the place where he shall lie. Thou shalt go in and cover his feet and lay thee down. He will tell thee what thou shalt do. She said unto her, all that thou sayest unto me I will do. Nothing like willing obedience and cooperation. Naomi was her counselor. And Naomi knew the lay of the land. She knew the customs in Israel. And Ruth could say, well, what in the world? I mean, the guy's laying down there and I'm going to go lay down. I mean, what's he going to think? She could come up with all kinds of rationale why it wouldn't work. But Naomi knows the customs. She knows, well, Boaz is going to receive this. Trust me, dear, I know things around here. She went down to the floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was merry. He went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn. She came softly and uncovered his feet and laid her down. Came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid and turned himself. And behold, a woman lay at his feet. The Hebrew is, he was startled, like anybody would be. Upon, you know, kind of in and out of sleep or dreaming or something, suddenly you discover there's somebody else next to you or at your feet, and you're startled. You wake up, and behold, a woman. He said, who art thou? She said, I'm Ruth. Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman. Now, Naomi put these words into her mouth. Spread your skirt over me meant offer me your protection. Take me into your house, into your skirt, under your wing. And also thou art a near kinsman. There are two things being asked. One is that he would be a kinsman to them and give children, at least a son, an heir, to Mahlon and then back to Elimelech, that there be an heir to the house of Elimelech. But second of all, she's asking his skirt be spread over her. She's asking him to be her husband. And that was not required of a kinsman. That would just be, since he's an old man, probably not in the marriage category anyway. She's probably not competing with anybody else. And she's asking for this as well. He's not obligated for this. Verse 10, he said, blessed be thou of the Lord. Thou hast showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followest not young men, whether poor or rich. Now he took this as even a greater sacrifice than the sacrifice of gleaning and coming to Israel and supporting and loving Naomi. This was the sacrifice of giving up a husband that would be to her own age, to carry on the seed of in the house of Elimelech. And so he interprets this as honorable, as right, as proper. Now, in the current move of God, there's a lot of solical judgments being made. There's a lot of people interpreting things in a certain light. And you could look at this passage and say evil things about Ruth and what are her intentions. Well, yeah, and then there's that Boaz fellow. We've watched him. But Boaz says, all the people of the city doth know thou art a virtuous woman. Verse 11. Her virtue and reputation is already known in the city. Anybody that would say anything negative about her to defame her reputation or her character would be doing so in opposition to a testimony of virtue that has already been established and known. It's really good to have a testimony of virtue. It's really good to have high standards, because in the hour of accusation, you can fall back on your testimony and say, the accusations made against me are out of character with the life I've lived up to this time. And of course, anybody can make accusations at any time. And you're really defenseless. It's just your word against theirs. And then there's all the innuendo and accusation of cover-up and all this stuff. And you're stuck. So you're stuck. I mean, there's nothing you can do. It's pretty hard to prove you're innocent in these kind of situations. This is why it's so important to start establishing your testimony now. Start establishing your testimony of honesty, integrity. This is not the time to be fudging on your income tax return and all kinds of other things, because one of these days they're going to do everything they can to get you. They're going to go over everything you've ever done to try to discredit you. And mark my words, I am telling you the truth. The devil is going to go over your life with a fine-tooth comb. And they're going to investigate you more than the top secret clearance at Boeing. And believe me, they investigate you. I mean, they really investigate you. Just remember that Spiro T. Agnew very quietly resigned from the vice presidency. Just quietly resigned. He pleaded no contest to tax evasion and just quietly disappeared from the scene. I want you to know that to a politician, a public figure, or a minister, your whole life is under the spotlight of the microscope. And you just better have, and you just better have a pretty good life. You just better be without flaw. And, well, nobody will catch me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not today they won't. But 10 years from today, when you're Jimmy Swaggart, man, they'll go over. They'll look at your life when you were 9. They'll try to find fault. Honestly. They'll go back in history and they'll look for a way to discredit you. And not everybody's going to be a Jimmy Swaggart, but you never know what God's going to do with your life. You become important enough to God and important enough to the devil, and he'll really do everything he can. It's amazing what skeletons have been pulled out of the closet on people's lives. You know, it's just been amazing. You just wouldn't believe what they'll do. And the devil's at work now, doing this kind of thing. The dissidents, I mean, they are going over things with a fine-tooth comb. They are following people around at times, honestly, tailing people, trying to catch them in an indiscretion. Do you know there are people that make a living with a camera? They make a living photographing royalty in England and other movie stars, and the most expensive, and they sell these pictures to these local rags, you know, they sell in the grocery store, these, what do they call them? Inquirer. National Enquirer. I call them reputation blasters or whatever. They're the local gossip magazine. And If they could ever get a picture of these people in some kind of an indiscretion or a sin, it'd be worth $500,000. Blackmail, if not for blackmail. You just don't know what's going on. And it's not, you know, God take us up enough. And maybe we're on our way down now. But, you know, he take us up enough. And, I mean, they'll sick these people on your trail and pay them some sum to try to get you. I mean, anything is possible. I don't want to put paranoia all over you. I'm just saying there's two ways to live. One way is to live so that you don't get caught. Another way is to live so that it doesn't matter if you do. Doesn't matter if you do. In other words, there's nothing in your life that you are ashamed of or have to hide at any time. In my opinion, that's the kind of life that Jesus led. When they got up there, they had to hire false witnesses against him because they couldn't come up with anything else. And if they could come up with anybody that wasn't a false witness, they'd have had them. So you'd better make sure that your life is such that they have to hire false witnesses against you. Now, a lot of evil could be spoken against the actions of Ruth here, who is a testimony for virtue, because if you look at it solically and read all kinds of evil motives into it, you can come up with all kinds of things. You know, I have literally laughed at some of the things I have heard. I mean, I can't even bring them up, but some of the things that the dissidents are parroting around are just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. They are building a case, defaming motives and other things on the most ridiculous evidence. I mean, they'll pick every part of your life apart. If your shirts are too expensive, they'll make a deal of that. If they're not, they'll make a deal of that. I mean, it's ridiculous. I have heard some of the silliest things. Oh. Anyway, God knew that that Ruth was a virtuous woman, and that's what counts. Verse 13. Tarry this night, and it shall be in the morning, that if he will perform unto thee the part of a kinsman, well, let him do the kinsman part. Now, there was somebody else that was near. This unknown kinsman, he's a type of the law. He is near, but he cannot redeem. Boaz is a type of Christ. He can redeem. Boaz is willing to sacrifice. She lay at his feet until the morning. She arose up before one could know another. He said, let it not be known that a woman came onto the floor. It's not always wrong to cover things up. Sometimes you have to use wisdom. There was really nothing wrong in what happened, but it was still wise to cover it up. It's still wise to protect, lest there be rumors floating around and accusations made. Do you know, you may be totally in the spirit and all kinds of other things, but you need to use wisdom where you are and what you do in front of who. I mean, there you need to protect yourself. You need to not cast pearls before swine. And I've made the comment, close the door to the bridal chamber. Don't leave the door open to all the gawkers to look in there and misjudge what's going on. When you're in relationship with Jesus, there are people, they can't understand those kind of things. They don't know what's going on. I mean, don't flaunt it in front of sinners, immature Christians, judgmental Christians, and people in our own body that are going to misjudge it and not understand it. I think we need to use wisdom and discretion. Bring the veil that thou hast upon thee and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, who art thou? Meaning, how did it go? She told her all that the man had done to her. She said, these 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said unto me, go not empty to thy mother-in-law. Then said she, sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall. The man will not be in rest until he hath finished the thing this day. Let Boaz handle it. Now Ruth did not become the bride in the field. She became the bride at his feet. However, she did not become the bride at his feet only. She was still in the field also, and that was an important part of it. But she became the bride at his feet, that is, in his presence. There's a relationship that has to develop. Also, she, as it were, made an overture to him. Now, in almost all societies, the man makes overture to the woman. And, of course, in the type, Jesus has loved us, not we him. In other words, he's gone out and brought us in, and so forth. But this is another aspect of a truth, is that you have to make yourself towards him. You have to propose to him, and that is, you have to say to him, I want to be in that intimate relationship with you. You have to pursue him. You have to come to his feet. I mean, there's a truth here. It's not just he's going to come along and sweep you off your feet. Now, in the spirit, there's some truth to that. But you've got to go to him. You've got to propose to him. You've got to constrain him. You've got to make it known that you want this. He's not going to force himself on any bride that isn't interested or isn't willing. Chapter 4. Boaz went up to the gate and waited for the man, who's the unknown kinsman, to come. And he said, ho such a one, or as we would say, hey so and so. Purposely leaving his name unknown. He took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit ye down here. They sat down. 10 witnesses. He said unto the kinsman, Naomi that is come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land which was our brother Elimelech's. I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. If thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it beside thee, and I am after thee. He said, I will redeem it. It was financially advantageous to redeem Elimelech's land. He could use it himself, gain further crops, give Naomi a percentage of it. It was his right to buy it first as a kinsman, and so it was a good move. Then said Boaz, well, there's one string attached. What day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. The kinsman said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, I cannot redeem it. Now the law could do partially, but not fully, what God required for redemption. The unknown kinsman representing the law could not fulfill all of the requirements. Now, marring his own inheritance, well, the land would immediately become the property of the heir that Ruth would bear. He would pay for the land, and then he would have to give it back up again to this heir soon to be born. There is also a possibility of her being a Moabite. That might reflect back on his family, or there might be some type of a stigma to that. In some way, there was a negative aspect of it in the fact that Ruth was also involved. He was not willing to mar his own inheritance. Now, Christ is willing to mar his inheritance. He gave up his eternal life that we might have ours. The law could not, but Christ did. The unknown kinsman did not love Ruth like Boaz did. He did not love her. The law does not love. It judges. It measures. The law could not bring forth children. The law looked at the outward, the Moabite aspect. and could not redeem. It can only judge. Verse 7, this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. To confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor. And this was a testimony in Israel. Well, we said the shoe represented ownership. Back at the time of Joshua, wherever the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that shall be yours. Taking off his shoe symbolized a renouncing of his ownership or possession rights. Therefore the kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thee. So he drew off his shoe. Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, ye are witnesses this day. I have bought all that was Elimelech's, all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren. And from the gate of his place, ye are witnesses this day. All the people said, the Lord make the woman like Rachel, who bore Joseph and Benjamin, and like Leah, who bore six. Let the house be like the house of Phares, whom Tamar bare unto Judah. And of the seed which the Lord shall give to thee of this woman. Boaz took Ruth, she became his wife. The Lord gave her a son. Now, Boaz is a type of Christ. He has the love, the compassion. He has the monetary means to redeem us. You had to be able to afford the redemptive price. Also, he purchased a peculiar people, a Moabite, a Gentile. Christ risked marring his own inheritance. Boaz's name means in him is strength. In him is strength. Now, the kinsman redeemer, there were three things that the kinsman had to do. One was to raise up children. If your brother die and leave a widow, and there be no heir, you are to give her seed that there might be children to inherit the land and carry on the name. The second thing that the kinsman would do was to redeem or buy back the mortgage property of a poor brother, or also his own soul, should he mortgage himself in slavery, buy him back. The third thing the kinsman redeemer was to do was to be the avenger of blood and to pursue the manslayer to the city of refuge, or to catch him and kill him should he not go to the city of refuge. That is the third thing, the avenger of blood. Boaz was the second near kinsman, but the first near kinsman gave up his right of redemption, and so Boaz filled in. Now Christ has fulfilled the type of the kinsman redeemer. He has bought back all that we have mortgaged, which is both our life and our inheritance. We mortgaged the Garden of Eden. We've mortgaged our eternal life. We mortgaged the tree of life through sin. And Christ has bought that back. We've mortgaged our own souls into the lake of fire, and Christ has bought us back. Also, Christ is the avenger of blood. He shall judge. He shall sit on the great judgment. And Christ is the one that has brought forth fruit or seed or offspring, spiritual sons and daughters, to those who are barren and have not brought forth anything. So Christ has fulfilled the duty of the kinsman. The woman said unto Naomi, blessed be the Lord, which hath not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. She called the child's name Obed. Obed became Naomi's kinsman. Obed became Naomi's kinsman. Not in a purely a literal sense, but in the sense that he was going to build up Elimelech's house. Verse 15, he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life, a nourisher of thine old age, thy daughter-in-law which loveth thee, which is better to thee than 7 sons, hath borne him. So Obed, as it were, was her kinsman. Naomi took the child, laid it in her bosom, and became nurse unto it. Not necessarily literally, although that is a possibility, but probably in the sense of caring for it and loving it and so forth. Obed is the father of Jesse, the father of David. So this son that was born here is the grandfather of David. Any comments or questions on the book of Ruth? Go ahead. I would make him a type of Satan because there's a sense in which he seeks to redeem but cannot. I don't know that Satan is in a position to do any redeeming or anything like this. It's like he's our adversary. I think the type of the Old Testament law fits better. It's closer in time, and it's God's first plan for man, and yet it could not redeem because of sin, because of the weakness of the flesh. So I don't see how Satan would really fit. Seems to run contrary to the tenor. Yeah, Satan has the right to us because of our sin, but he doesn't have the right to redeem us. He has the right to punish us and afflict us. So it's a little different situation. Another question. Go ahead.
That point you brought up in the very beginning of chapter 3, I think it was, you were talking about because of Boaz's age, she can propose to him. Can you just talk about that again? I didn't understand. Just what the point was.
Well, because of Boaz's age, you know, an honorable man at that age would probably not pursue a younger woman, just feeling like somebody more her own age would be deserving of her, etc., etc., etc. In other words, he might feel that it would be unfair to her to put her in a marriage relationship with a man as old as he was, who may not have certain things to offer her that she might be needing. And so it put her in a position to propose to him and, as it were, come to him and say, I'm making the sacrifice. I want to be married to you. I want to redeem Elimelech's house and Naomi's house. And so it put it all in her lap, and then he received it totally as an honorable thing. Now, I know that Boaz loved this woman. But probably because of his high honor, he would never allow those feelings to provoke him to a marriage type of attitude. But he would just hold them in a certain way, feeling like, I'm too old for her, this isn't proper, it wouldn't be fair to her, and so I'll keep my feelings to myself. That's where I think he was. And her mother-in-law maybe have sniffed a little bit of this out and felt like, well, it's our job to let him know that we don't feel that way. And so she came to him. Oh, I don't think any custom in Israel was the girl to approach him. I just think it was more his age put him in a category where he would probably not come to her. Go ahead. Ruth. Commentators tell me that the meaning of her name is arbitrary and hard to define, and so I don't have a definition for it. Let me see if I do. But because it's a Moabite name, it's harder to... means friend. Uh, companion or friend. Another commentary says vision or beauty. Kyle and Delitzsch say quite uncertain. Meaning of the names of Moabitish women cannot be satisfactorily explained from the Hebrew. So I would say friend sounds like a great guess because of the story and the way that it fits her personality and her life. Why not? But maybe there also be some arbitrariness there in choosing that. Another question. 1 Samuel. Test on Judges will include the book of Ruth. And as far as the test questions on the book of Ruth, the typological overview of the book, you need to know that, and also a few things about the kinsman redeemer. That's pretty much all there is. The rest of the story, I'm sure you know pretty well. When do you want it? How about 2 weeks from today? How about on a Friday? You have to know the 13 judges. You have to know the 6 servitudes, the main judges. Othniel, Ehud, Gideon, Deborah, Jephthah, and Samson. Those are the 6 ones that have a narrative to them. Tola, J.R., Abdon, and all these guys. You just need to know their names. And just the general story of the book. Test on the book of Judges is almost all out of the King James Bible. There's not a lot of typology in the book. And then the questions on Ruth, the typological overview of the book, what Elimelech represents, the 2 sons, Ruth, Boaz, unknown kinsman, and Naomi. You had to know those things. And then the kinsman redeemer, 3 things, 3 duties of the kinsman. 14th of November. 1 Samuel. 1 and 2 Samuel are one book in the Hebrew. They became 2 in the Greek translation of the Hebrew called the Septuagint. From that, they became 2 in our English Bible. 1 Samuel takes about 115 years, according to Usher. 1 Samuel records the birth of Samuel, the last judge, to the death of Saul, the first king. 2 Samuel is David's 40-year reign. It's 40 years, it's David's reign. 1 Samuel has 3 main characters: Samuel, Saul, and David. Samuel lived to see David come into prominence. Saul lived until David was 30 years old. Samuel founded the school of the prophets. He is the last judge, and Samuel is not a military leader, although he did deliver Israel, but he delivered Israel through the prophetic ministry, the teaching ministry, and administration, and organizing the kingdom. Samuel is the first of a new order of prophets. And although the government moves from the judges to kings, the spiritual leadership of the nation falls on the shoulders of the prophets. God uses prophets to give spiritual direction and spiritual teaching and so forth. During the time of the book of Samuel, Israel was reduced in might and power by the growing Philistine nation. We left off the judges with Samson beginning to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And we see the Philistines basically having some measure of dominion over them, so much so that the tribe of Judah says, "Knowest thou not the Philistines have rule over us?" And they bind Samson and deliver him up. The Philistines continue on as their principal enemies, conquering them in 1 Samuel chapter 4, and plaguing them and eventually killing Saul in battle in the last chapter of the book. But it isn't until the time of David that they are subdued. All because Judah failed to conquer the seacoast. Samuel brought spiritual order to the nation, at least in a great measure. You can divide the book into three parts. Chapters 1 to 8 is the life of Samuel up until the anointing of Saul. Chapters 9 to 15 is Saul up until the call of David. And chapters 16 to 31 is centered around the life of David and his running from Saul and ministry and so forth. Looking at 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 1. There was a certain man of Mount Ephraim. His name was Elkanah. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. The latter had children, but Hannah had no children. This man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. When the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions. Unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. Her adversary, the other wife, also provoked her sore for to make her fret, because she bare no children. And as she did so, year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, she provoked her, therefore she wept and did not eat. And of course, Elkanah was grieved over this, and he said, "Why weepest thou? Am I not better than 10 sons?" So she went up to worship. Now, it never did work out to have two wives. See, it's never going to work out. Believe me, there's going to be competition, jealousies, and everything you can imagine. The type is one. It'll only work out one. Societies that have more than one do not have the relationship anywhere near. The women are all concubines. There's not even that much love in them. In fact, I know a missionary to Africa who had an unusual problem in the district that he was ministering in. It's called polygamy. And there were other missionary societies there, and some dealt with the problem and they totally ignored it. Others required a convert to give up all his wives except one. And he didn't know what to do. What do I do, Lord? I mean, what do I do when I go back to America and I tell them about the converts I've got and their 10 wives? Of course, wives were status among the tribes. More the merrier. And also the wives themselves liked more wives, because as they came in, they had a caste system among the wives, and the latter wives coming in had to do all the work, and the earlier wives had more of a prestigious position. And so the wives themselves like more wives because those wives end up doing all the dirty work. And then the whole system was just a mess. And interestingly enough, the man didn't sleep with any of them. He slept in a separate house and they all stayed in the wives' quarters. I mean, it's no kind of a marriage, no kind of a relationship at all. Well, he found out in the missionary societies that required the man to give up all his wives except one, he found out they were baptizing 95% liars. They weren't giving him up. They just said they were, but they kept on and everything else. And there was also the problem of giving up the wives is that they had nowhere to go in that society, so they all went home to witch doctor dad. And in that society, the women were non-entities. They had no personalities per se. They had no identity. They were either their fathers in their father's house, or they belonged to a husband in his house, and they were just basically like cattle, and they were treated like cattle and thought of like cattle. If he got saved, she got saved. If she was sent home to witch doctor dad, back to the occult she went. She had no commitment, it didn't last or anything like that. So this was a dilemma to him, and he didn't know what to do. Because if we make him give up the wives, they all go back to voodoo. If he keeps the wives, what kind of a testimony is that to Christ? It was a dilemma, believe me. There wasn't anything in the missionary manual on it, and there's not a whole lot of scriptures on it. It's one of those things you run into, and the Lord gives you wisdom. He decided to do nothing about it. He decided to baptize him, teach Christ, and see what would happen. And he said that the gospel message in Christianity cleared up the problem in and of itself. Because what it did was, it brought out the aspect of marriage that they didn't have, and pretty soon he found out that he was in love with one woman before long. In other words, there was no love in that society. It was just all a whole different relationship. And he found out, and because of the gospel, it brought the whole standard of living up and created an environment where he was living with one woman, and pretty soon he was sleeping with one woman. And the others became part of the family. They just became servants. And they didn't have to go down back to the voodoo. They stayed on also as servants. The gospel has a way of cleaning up things in and of itself. And you can't always deal with a problem at first glance because there's no practical way to deal with it. It's kind of like slavery. In the New Testament, Paul doesn't address slavery. But if the Christian society really takes hold, slavery will take on a new form. It'll really change, and it won't be the slavery that there once was. The gospel, and do unto others as you would do unto them, and love, and loving your brethren, will take society up out of the ills of society in and of itself. And this is the answer to all these problems out here in our society. It's not so much fight pornography as much as I hate it. It's convert men's hearts. You convert men's hearts, and that stuff will go out the window. People have asked me, well, what are you doing about the ills of society? I say, I'm preaching Jesus Christ. They want to know how that's going to help the ills of society. What are you doing for the poor? I'm preaching Jesus Christ. I remember when a group from PLU came up to our church, they wanted to know what we were doing for the poor. What were you doing for the good of society and all that? And we said, we're preaching Jesus Christ. They wanted to know what good that was. They said, well, how do you help these people? We say, well, when they get converted, they're God's problem. They're now his kingdom, and it's up to him to take care of them. But as long as they're unconverted and they're sinners, they're under his judgment anyway, so it's going to be really hard to help them. What we need to do is get them under his blessing. And then they're his problem, and he'll take care of them. That's the answer. It's the gospel message that's the answer. And it will clear up all the ills of society in and of itself, given time. Well, having two wives, what a mess. The word Lord of Hosts, titled Lord of Hosts, this is the first time this occurs in the Old Testament. It's found about 260 times, and the Hebrew is Yahweh Sabaoth, S-A-B-A-O-T-H. It doesn't have anything to do with the Sabbath. It means Yahweh of hosts, a manifestation of power or a warrior. Yahweh, the head of all the heavenly hosts. He is the Lord over all the armies and hosts of heaven. Verse 10. Hannah was up worshiping the Lord. She was in bitterness of soul and prayed and wept. She vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but wilt give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I'll give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. It's going to be like Samson, Nazarite. Now, Eli marked her mouth. The high priest was there, and he saw her praying. Now, Hannah represents the church, who's going to bear a man-child that's going to change the course of history. But God is waiting for the church to be brought to a place of desperation, where they'll vow a vow and give up this man-child unto God. The church isn't in any position to bear this child now. The church is lukewarm, backslidden. But God's got to bring her to a place of real revival and crying out. There's an agony to bear this child. There's a birth pang, and this birth pang is the crying out to be bring forth. Go ahead. That's true, and that's also an application. The only part I'm bringing out really that fits is that the church is going to go through agony to bear this child, and that it's going to take agony to bring a child like this. In other words, there's an aspect of the church, us, who are going to go through agony to produce this man-child in our own life, in our own body. We're not just going to... There's a sense in which the visible church is going to separate us and expel us out here as the man-child in rejection and persecution. But there's also a sense in which we've got to go through birth pangs to bring forth Christ in our own life, to bring this forth as a man-child. So that's really the aspect I'm bringing forth this time. And Hannah is the beloved wife here, not just the visible church which God rejects, so to speak. Hannah is the choice one, the one that Elkanah loves. And that church is going to go through agony to bring forth him that's under Nazarite vow. Now, she is in the agony of soul and worshiping the Lord in a way that wasn't really according to custom. She's worshiping the Lord in a way that maybe not that many other people worshiped. And maybe outwardly it didn't look that pretty. And Eli misunderstood her worship. This woman's doing business with God, and God is going to hear her, and he's giving her the son right at this time. In other words, he's answering this prayer. She's shortly going to conceive. At the very time of her moving in God in the depths of her soul, she's misjudged by others who know not what she's going through, judged in the outward. And the devil attacks her with discouragement. Verse 13, Hannah spake in her heart with her lips moving. This was a silent prayer. Eli thought she was drunken. Eli said to her, "How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee." He didn't just go up to her and say, "Sister, pardon me. My information is, I could be wrong, but the facts have come in. Are you drunken?" "Why, no, my lord." "Oh, fine." No, instead, it's a direct accusation. "Put away your wine from you. You're drunk." It's the old judge by the outward, assign a motive on outward appearance. This is what's happening to the current move of God. It may not be all that pretty, and the worship may be different than what people are used to seeing. But they're assigning that we're either drunk, i.e. in the flesh, and carnal. Drunken means in the flesh and carnal. That's what they think we are. They think we're in the flesh and carnal, having an affair. Others accuse the church in her hour of struggle of fanaticism and improper behavior. Now, when you get accused, don't react angrily and manifest demons. Realize that Hannah was accused, and so was Christ and many others, and just manifest love back. Say, "Brother, I forgive you for judging me and misunderstanding. I realize in your unspiritual state, you are incapable of evaluating correctly what God is doing in the Spirit. But I forgive you anyway." Now, you might not say it just like that, but it's the truth. Eli looked with unspiritual eyes and judged the woman's heart. She did not answer back in pout. "Well, I miffed. God knows my heart. Self-pity." She answered back and said, "No, my lord, I'm a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink. I've poured out my soul before the Lord. Count me not to be a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken. Eli, probably a little bit ashamed of himself, said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. She said, Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. She went her way, did eat, and her countenance was no more sad, because she had delivered her burden up to the Lord. She laid it up before the Lord, see? She was sad, she was in grief, she wasn't in agony, but she prayed it out, and it laid up before the Lord now. She's given it up to God. He's going to answer her petition, and she's going to give him time. When he decides to answer, it will be up to him. Now, she manifested a meek and a contrite spirit, even under accusation and attack. Even by those in spiritual leadership, misjudged my heart. Eli was a spiritual leadership. She could have received the devastating hurt of her life. How many are hurt by the pastor? Friend, give the pastor a break. He has no motive to hurt you or no ill design on you. The eldership hasn't either. The church leadership hasn't either. Where be all these hurts from the pastor? Nothing but the devil. And I am about at the point to lay the blame on the people hurt for being hurt. Boy, that's hard. I'm afraid I'm about at that point. I'm about at the point of saying, Brother, if you're hurt, it's your fault. Well, that's like stabbing a man when he's down. Well, I haven't really come to that point. I said I'm about at that point. But I'm saying this. We've got to grow up out of these hurts and not be such big babies. So thin skin. She did not receive a hurt from Eli the high priest. I mean, there are a lot of Christians who'd have gone home and said, I'm not going to that church anymore. If he's going to think that about me, well, I never. I mean, they'd manifest all that thin-skinned religion. I'm writing a letter to a person now. A person's supposed to be so spiritual. They're not spiritual, and they're manifesting unspirituality in their hour of trial, and I'm writing a letter telling them so. Ye that are so spiritual, be it. Don't be so thin-skinned and such a big baby. Now, this woman, I'm proud of this woman. She took a direct accusation in her hour of trial. You know, that's when it's really hard to take it. When you're really down and you're agonizing and you're really broken before the Lord, and somebody comes along and accuses you of being drunk, and that is a hard time to take it. That's when the devil can really get the hurt in deep. And what you need to do is you need to forgive Eli for carnal judgment and realize he made a carnal judgment and he was wrong. Forgive him. Forgive him. Eli wasn't really wanting to hurt this woman. Does Eli have a malicious intent towards her? No. He didn't have any malicious intent. He did what he shouldn't have done. He made an insensitive move. And a lot of people do. And we're not Christ yet, and we're not perfect. We're not perfectly sensitive to everybody's needs and everybody's problems. And, you know, it's easy to blame somebody or get on somebody when they're the one that's hurting and they're down and they're discouraged. And counselor can maybe, you know, they need love and sympathy, and the counselor can give them a rebuke. And, you know, you can't always do everything right if you're a counselor. And what does the person do? Hey, I want people to forgive me if I do that. I don't want them to blame me. Go into a big pit over it. This woman handled it in the right way, proving the depth of her spirituality. She was in a good place before God. And do you know the devil wants to come and discourage you and accuse you when you pour your heart out before God? He wants to do that so that you'll clam up and go into a demonic pout over it. Because about the time you're like Hannah, God's going to do something big in your life. See, her heart's open. She's crying out in a real place of commitment. God's going to do something. So the devil wants to come right in there and get you judged by somebody or criticized or roommates are critical of you. Verse 20. Came to pass when the time was come, about after Hannah had conceived, She bare a son and called his name Samuel, meaning asked of God. Asked of God. That's our last bell. We'll continue on here next time.